the next 15 to 20 minutes, and then I've already consulted with the timer. Let me know when I have 5 minutes left. So I'm Lance. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Lance.
My childhood, I used to talk a lot about my childhood. I guess I won't anymore. I'll just say it was full of a lot of chaos and emotional abuse. I didn't have to suffer any physical abuse, which was nice, which was very good. Although, And so the kind of the central issue in my childhood was my mom. I believe my mom was mentally ill. In her later years, she was diagnosed with schizophrenia and borderline personality disorder. When I was living with my mom, it was really borderline personality disorder. She had a few delusions occasionally. She would always have delusions of persecution, like this boyfriend, cut my brake lines or something when she needed a brake job on the car, but it was really the borderline. It was really the crazy, the one moment, she loves me, and then the next moment she's screaming at me for hours and hours, and telling me what a horrible per human being I am, and then I do something to get in her good graces, and now she adores me again. And it was that real, hot and cold, the black and white thinking. And so as we went through life, well, anyway, so I won't say much about that. It was just a lot of emotional abuse. And then because our mom loved us and then hated us, and oh, I have a twin brother, so I will always, for when I give these kind of testimonials, I always talk in the second person, because I always imagine Larry's here because he's my twin brother. But so the two of us went back and forth between our mom and dad our whole childhood, because our mom would want us, and then we'd live with her, and then she hated us, and then we'd live with our dad, and then she'd want us back because she was lonely, and we'd be back with our mom. And so this went on, and this was back in the 60s, where when you had a divorce with kids, mom always got the kids. There was no such thing as joint custody yet. No one got joint custody. It just didn't happen. And in 1965, joint custody didn't happen, So anyway, also when we were living with our mom during my teenage years, during our teenage years, I wound up kind of getting, back in the 90s and the 2000s, they would use the phrase emotional incest. So I was kind of the husband role in my mom's life. So I would do a lot of cooking. I would, if our mom was hungover, oh, my mom was, she was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And so when she was hungover or couldn't make it to work, I would call her job and say, "Hi, my mommy's sick, she can't come in today." And I would deal with stuff. I would take care of stuff in the home if something broke or something went wrong. Also, when she would have difficulties with her latest boyfriend or her latest job, I would be kind of her unlicensed therapist. I would listen to her and give her advice. And she had a whole bookshelf full of self-help books. So by age 11, I had read all of them. And this is back in the 70s. So it was like, "I'm okay, you're okay," and "Games People Play," all these, the kind of the self-help books of the 60s and 70s. So I kind of built up a little bit of knowledge about psychology, and so I would help her out. So that was all very stressful and inappropriate, and it was really like, life was about her and her needs, and not about me, except how I could help her. Okay, so when I was 5 years old, I'll never forget the first time I ate a chocolate bar. It was a Nestle's Crunch bar. I was around 5 years old, and I ate it, and just this feeling of warmth and happiness came over me. From very, very early, I always used food to help me get through stressful times, and think times were always stressful living with our mom. And chocolate in particular was just a mood-altering substance. And so all growing up, I would eat a bunch of chocolate every day. Whenever I was sad or angry or lonely or frustrated, I would get a chocolate bar, And back then, you could, Three Musketeers bar was like 5 cents, and so so by the time, so now let me, so childhood was awful. It was just terrible. And so then, fast forward to college, made it through my undergraduate, and then I started teaching at Cal Poly. So I entered the master's program in math at Cal Poly and started teaching. And that's when my chocolate addiction really got out of hand. So my dad died in 1984, and he died of a heart attack, died really young. So I was 23 when my dad died. And so on the 1 year anniversary of my dad dying, I got super, super, super depressed. And so I said, this is back when schools actually paid to have like actual therapy, when colleges got money from the state and federal government. And so there's a therapist there. So I got to see a therapist a few times, and he gave me some testing, and I tested as being suicidally depressed, and he was all scared and calling me at home. And so he was asking me, well, tell me about your eating habits, tell me about your sleeping habits. And I told him, well, I stay up till 3 in the morning or 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning every night. I sleep until noon the next day. I don't get anything done. When I wake up, I have a bunch of chocolate. Then I drive to Cal Poly, teach my class, go to the candy store at Cal Poly, buy a couple of pounds of chocolate covered peanuts, eat those in the car on my way home. Then I get home and I have fudge brownie ice cream. And that was like my whole diet. And he says, Lance, wow, you're eating a lot of chocolate. Your depression, this is really, really going to make your depression a lot worse. Maybe you should stop eating chocolate. So I said, okay. And so I stopped eating chocolate and I just ate healthy food and within 3 days, I was out of the depression. And so then I realized, well, chocolate for me is like cocaine, and it was weird because my mom was a drug addict and an alcoholic. So I've never been drunk, I've never been high, I've never experimented with any drugs. But lo and behold, chocolate was, I mean, just imagine if I discovered marijuana. Oh my God, that's all I would just be high of 10, 2, and 4, So I after 3 days, it was like I woke up out of a nightmare. It was like a year-long nightmare of just chocolate. I'd eat chocolate and I'd get super happy for an hour or two, and then I'd be really depressed, and I'd eat more chocolate and be happy and then depressed. And this up and down was just making me depresser and depresser and crazier. So I realized in 1985 that I needed to give up chocolate. This was a thing. And for the next 2 years, I couldn't give up chocolate. It was I would give it up for a couple of days, and then I'd be back on it and give it up for a couple of days and be back on it. It was impossible for me to give up chocolate until finally, April 18th, 1987, I was at UCLA, starting the process of getting my almost PhD in math at UCLA. And I had a friend who I went to undergraduate with who said, Lance, and I was talking to her and crying, and I couldn't, I'm so depressed, and I just feel horrible. And so she said, Lance, I think you need to go to Overeaters Anonymous. I think that's your hope, your only hope. So I went to my first OA meeting, April 18th, 1987, and that was the last day that I ate chocolate. And so yay, I know, which was awesome. So that was amazing. That was just a miracle for me. So I went to the meetings there for a couple of years, got a lot of support. I didn't ever do my fourth step during that time, but just going to the meetings and reading the big book all the time, like discovering the big book for me was like the first when I discovered the Bible. It was just like, oh my God, this is like the Word of God. This is so incredible. But there was one line in there that I really loved so much that was a combination of frightening and encouraging. And that was that line very early in the book where he says, this works for everybody, no matter who you are. This program will help you stay off of alcohol. The only people we have ever seen not benefit from this are people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. For these, poor people, their chances are less than average, And so that always got me. Well, I'm honest with myself, so I'm not one of these crazy alcoholics in denial of all the damage that I'm causing around me, So that's good. And so, but anyway, so I just want to bring that up because that's kind of what I want to focus on a little bit for the rest of my talk. So I had a lot of support. And when I moved from Westwood back to the Inland Empire, I started getting involved in our OA here. And then I just kind of fell out of it. I stayed away for maybe 10 years or so, or 15 years, something like that. Because, I just wasn't eating chocolate anymore, and I was never depressed, and I never had these black depressions where I was just couldn't get out of bed. You know, that didn't happen to me anymore. So it's like, well, 08 did its thing, and now I'm done. Until in the early 2000s, I started to now have this a little bit of the relationship with food in general that I used to have with chocolate, where I was using food to deal with my feelings and to avoid my feelings. And when I'm sad, I eat. When I'm lonely, I eat. When I'm frustrated, I eat. When I'm happy, I eat, you know. And so I started to gain weight. And that was when I came back to Overeaters Anonymous, because I thought, well, okay, I'm not doing chocolate anymore, which means I'm not going to kill myself, but this is a more insidious kind of addiction. So I started going to Overeaters Anonymous again, and this time I got a sponsor, and I started doing my steps, the fourth step, with my sponsor. And oh, I'm sorry, I thought I how come my call went through? I'm on airplane mode. Okay, that was weird. Okie dokie. Wow. I'll have to look at that. Maybe that little airplane doesn't mean what I think it means. Okay, so now what was interesting is I thought, so my sponsor is like a genius. He's like an amazing high IQ guy, even though he's very, very, very humble. Because I guess he went, you know, he makes chicken coops. I don't want to give away who he is, but he used to make chicken coops. But he's a genius, and I thought the fourth step was about me writing all the terrible things in my life I've done, all the selfish, thoughtless things I've done in my life. But he kept just focusing over and over on the what are the lies you tell yourself, and that's always every single part of that fourth step for me. What are the lies you tell yourself? And it turns out that for me, like all everything I need as far as my recovery lies in that question. Because the only people this program doesn't help for are people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. I'll allow you for these. For these dumb people, alas, their chances are less than average. And so that was the thing. And the lies I tell myself, it's always God doesn't love me. You know, step two, I don't believe step two. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me sanity. No, I don't believe that, because God doesn't love me, because I'm just worthless, and I'm not smart enough, and I'm not good enough. So you know, those are the lies. No one loves me. I'm fat and ugly and horrible. You know, I think I'm smart, but I'm really stupid, you know, and I can't get anything right, and I fucked up again, you know, and these lies that I constantly tell myself were the things that were preventing me from recovery, especially always taking back my second step. No, I don't think God, I don't think I have a higher power. I don't think I have a friend with a capital F who's interested in my recovery, as Bill W. refers to God as, you know. I don't believe any of that, because how could he love me? I mean, look at how I grew up. You know, all of the feedback I ever got from any adult growing up was always that I'm unlovable. And so, you know, and that was the biggest, that's so for me right now, the biggest thing I'm dealing with right now, the biggest thing that helps me in my recovery is to always ask myself, is this a lie I'm telling myself? You know, so some of the lies, the big lies I'm to the biggest lie is always God doesn't love me. Another big lie is so I'm, you know, I'm struggling. And then what I did, something that would have been impossible for me when I was in my 20s and 30s, I went to medical school. So when I was 47 years old, when I was 45, I went to a prayer meeting for 10 days, and then I got this idea that God wants me to be a doctor, and that I've always wanted to be a doctor. My dad died really young from heart disease, and so I've always I've always felt really guilty about that. Like if I were smart enough, I would have read up on heart disease and given our dad better care so that he lived longer than he did. And so that became like an obsession with me. And then I realized, well, I should be a doctor. I want to be a doctor. I want to help other people not go through this agony of losing loved ones or being sick and having inadequate or incompetent care. And so at age 45, I started the process. I was going to three different colleges simultaneously to get all my pre-med classes. And then I did really, really well on the MCAT. And then I went to medical school and became a doctor. And medical school and residency is like by a factor of 10, the most stressful and difficult thing I've ever done. And if I weren't in Overeaters Anonymous, if I wasn't getting emotional support, and you know, if I, there were some of the people in this program that I would call and get advice from, and if I didn't have that, there's no way it would have been impossible for me, you know, in my younger years to have finished medical school and been a doctor. So that was a wonderful time for me, but unfortunately, 5 minutes, I gained a lot of weight during that time because most, it's like weird. It's like you can have a month of abstinence and you can undo that in a 2 day binge. And so that's what would happen to me. I would just forget everything about that God loves me and that these people love me. And then I would just overeat and binge for 2 days, you know, and then that's it. I'm fat again, you know, and you know how that goes. So I had to give up being a doctor because it ended up being too stressful for me. After the COVID years, you know, just the amount of work that family doctors are supposed to do, it just got too much for me. I got older, I got slower, and my number of patients I'm supposed to see went from 18 to 26, and it was just too much for me. And then the charting was too much for me. It took way too long to chart, you know, to always on the computer, you know, hours a day. So I gave that up and I'm back to teaching. And so, but the thing is, so the basic, so I'm so sorry. I wish this were a better share, but sorry. But anyway, okay. So the biggest things that are helping me right now, number one, I am on Ozempic. So that's supposed to help me lose weight, but you know, you can binge eat on Ozempic. I learned that. Now the Ozempic punishes you. You know, you just get a horrible diarrhea and bloating, and it's awful. But you can still binge. You know, when I was told I was given two classes to teach this fall at Mount SAC, and then the chairman of the department called and said, "Remember those two classes you got?" Yeah. Well, we've decided to take them back because part full-timers wanted those classes instead. So sorry. And then I binged for like a week after that. And then he called back and it was like, JK, you know, no, you still got those classes, you know. And I'm like, why did I binge for a week? And so I still, when life feels, you know, because when I got that call, I just thought, well, that's it. You know, there's nothing in the universe that wants me to be happy or useful. And I just kind of had went temporarily insane after that. So I still have those issues, the issues of lies that I tell myself. Another thing that happens to me with the lies I tell myself is there'll be someone in my life who I love and who loves me, and we've had a wonderful relationship. And then if they say or do something, you know, thoughtless or whatever, I'll suddenly realize, oh, it was all fake. It was all a sham, you know? And then I'll like ghost the person. And I've done that a bunch of times in my life. I've ghosted, I look back in my life and I've ghosted a lot of friends, a lot of important people, just because I just got it in my head, well, I'm unlovable, you know? And that's even in medicine, that's what happened. I always thought, well, I'm a big imposter and I'm not a good doctor and I'm just a fat old guy trying to be a good doctor. Even though, you know, on my board exams and licensing exams, I was 80th percentile, which is really awesome. I mean, you know, I was the fattest, oldest medical school student in Southern California, and I'm 80th percentile. That's awesome. You know, that you wouldn't expect that at all. You know, but even in the view of actual data, I was still lie to myself about how incompetent and unlovable I am. And so I'm really trying to undo that, you know. So what am I doing to undo that? Well, for me, writing my feelings, writing my thoughts, sometimes having a dialogue where I say, God, what are you wanting to tell me right now? And write down what I feel in my heart God is kind of sharing with me. Writing is the most important thing I do to talk myself out of the lies that I tell myself. The second thing is, well, so I'm also a huge computer game addict. And in fact, computer gaming and eating kind of combined, like during that binge that I had, a couple of months ago. It was really computer games 12 hours a day and then eating at my desk while I play on the computer. So the two of them really go hand in hand. So about 4 weeks ago, I erased the computer game that I was addicted to. Yeah. And so for 4 weeks, I've had no computer games and my life has been amazing for the last 4 weeks. So after writing and praying, the second most important thing I do for about the lies that I tell myself is I'm always calling people, talking to people. I know there's a lot of people who care about me and love me in my life. You know, one thing that my sponsor and my sponsor's sponsor would always say says, you have enough right now. You have all the love you need right now. You have all the people who care about you that you need right now. You just have to acknowledge it, be aware of it, you know. And there's nothing more that you need. Just be grateful for what you have. And so that's the third thing I do. I'm now for the last 4 weeks, I've just been calling people, visiting with people, going out to coffee with people. It's really a wonderful life. Not playing on the computer 12 hours a day is a much, much better life than when I was playing and eating, you know. So that's really important to me too. Reading the big book is still magic, you know. So that's the fourth thing. I'm reading the big book. That's the only literature I'm really reading right now is the big book, you know. But it's just magic the impact that it has. And then number five, going to meetings. You know, I'm going to about three or four meetings a week, and that's good. That seems to be the minimum I need. So anyway, that thanks for letting me share.
Okay, Lance.
Okay. Okay, so well.